In 1986, singer, songwriter, and producer Peter Gabriel opened the doors to his legendary Real World Studios in Wiltshire, England. Over the years, musicians from Bonnie Raitt to Deep Purple, from Robert Plant to Nigel Kennedy, have recorded at this former grain mill surrounded by sheep farms 100 miles west of London. But Real World has always been more than just a place for heavy hitters to lay down tracks and dash off mixes. Its mission has also been to provide a state-of-the-art space for musicians from around the world to meet and mingle, try out new sounds, and exchange ideas. In the early 90s, the studio opened for what was called Recording Weeks, and some 75 artists from 20 countries came to play. In those heady days of musical experimentation, artists recorded in every nook and cranny of the complex. So many tapes piled up, there soon became no room to store them. Today, almost two decades later, we finally will hear the fruits of that labor. On Tuesday, Big Blue Ball is released on Real World Records. Many points of the globe are represented on Big Blue Ball. There's Congolese singer Papa Wemba, Sinead O'Connor from Ireland, the Holmes Brothers with American gospel, string players from Egypt, percussionists from Japan, and flutists from China. And that is just a small sample. Peter Gabriel acted as curator and sings on several tracks, and he joins us now from his home in London. Hello, Peter. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Leanne. Thank you very much.
So I guess the first and most obvious question is, what took so long for the CD to come out?
Well, as you said, we created a mountain of tapes. And I think every time that somebody looked at them, they sort of backed away. And we eventually found someone brave enough, Stephen Haig, who's here with me today, actually, with Carl Wallinger. He agreed to dive in there. Mm-hmm. And it took him several attempts over several years. But he was the man brave enough or foolish enough to try and sort out all the mess that we created. But, you know, it was a fertile mess, I think.
We're going to talk to Stephen and Carl in just a moment. But can I talk to you just a little bit about those recording weeks in the early 90s? You described it as a dating service with a 24-hour cafe.
Yeah, well, you know musicians.
Yeah.
I think we were trying to get a certain number of records done as well, but I think the exciting thing for a lot of us was that there were musicians from all over the world, sort of songwriters, poets, all thrown together, and all sorts of connections happened.
No rhyme or reason, no way to make it easy. It's done.
I think they are the most fun weeks I've ever had in the studio, without question, you know, and it's from a writer's point of view, it sort of takes you back to a time when, say, the Brill Building was full of songwriters and they'd come in at 9 o'clock and have a song by six when they went home.
Let's bring in another of this triumvirate. We're talking to co-producer Carl Wallinger from World Party and the Waterboys. Hey, Carl.
Hi.
Hi. You've described this project as something akin to providing a train and a track for the artists. So what was the journey like for you?
Well, sort of round in circles, probably. No, it wasn't really round in circles. No, it was just a great. It was a great thing. I was just asked by Peter to come along and sort of join in, and it was just like a musical health farm, really. There wasn't any considerations other than the sounds you heard in the room, you know, which were always pretty extraordinary and played by people who had been mastering their instrument in whatever way, you know, for however many years. I mean, I just think the collective musical years that had gone down amongst everybody there would have been sort of well into the thousands, you know.
How did the process work? I mean, you know, who was writing the songs? How did they evolve?
I think they just sort of came about, really. I mean, there'd be, if you're planning on getting people to play together on some unknown piece that doesn't really have any shape, we basically used a kind of rhythm or just a pulse of some sort we'd set up, and then we'd start laying things on the top.
thing, Stephen Haig?
Yes.
You really dug into this project to put it in some kind of manageable form. A very daunting task, surely. I mean, where did you begin?
Where did I begin? There was a lot of listening involved, and between me and Peter in particular, we narrowed it down. One thing that I ran by Peter as I digested some, you know, was quite familiar with what had been recorded, and had some thoughts about what, you know, where it could be taken, was what kind of latitude that I would have in creating final mixed versions of these tracks, besides editing the material that was there. And Peter said, as long as it ends up being a great record, whatever you think it takes. And I always tried to stay true to the spirit of the sessions, and just made sure that I wasn't losing track of the spirit of what had gone on.
Peter, did you have to mediate artistic differences?
No, actually, it was very easy. And Carl has a wicked sense of humor, too, which has kept most of us in hysterics. So I think there wasn't a lot of room for rampant egos.
Carl, how would you diffuse if any egos that started to blow up?
Oh, I'd pull out a gun or throw a bucket of water over someone just as they were plugging in an electric utensil.
Oh, that'll work.
No, I don't know. There weren't really any kind of artistic sort of railheads or whatever. You know, there were people were so kind of interested. They wanted to put their bit on there. I think that's the only bit of ego that happened, that people wanted to join in.
What use is it to wash that stuff away? In every place that we have run to, all that we've become with was there to stay.
I'm going to ask you all this question, and Carl, I'll start with you. What do you think you learned about the creative process by bringing all of these artists together?
I learned it's universal, and I learned that music is an amazing thing to unite people. I don't know, I just think it was such a different experience as well, because being able to play with people who you'd never be, they wouldn't come into your sphere of experience otherwise, you know, so it was a great opportunity.
Stephen Haig, let me ask you the same question. What did you learn about the creative process and watching and listening to all these artists making music together?
Well, particularly on the, working with the recordings more or less after the fact, hearing things in isolation and realizing that one performance would not have happened if it hadn't been responding to another previous performance, or, you know, these people from divergent musical cultures being in the room at the same time. Just amazing, some of the things that happened that would never have had an opportunity to have happened in any other format, really, which is a great thing about this project. It was a real unique opportunity for these people to get together. And also there's a sense of joy in the recordings, that even in some of the extended jams that I was dealing with sometimes, where people seem to be looking for ideas, someone would kind of come in from left field with something, and suddenly it would set off a whole chain reaction of things amongst the other players. And it's just a really great thing to be a part of.
I just think music's a language of communication that shouldn't exclude anyone. It's a great means of connecting and communicating emotion and ideas. And I know it's been said 1,000 times, and it's a cliche, but it became very real for us at those sessions.
Big Blue Ball is released Tuesday on Real World Records. Peter Gabriel and your colleagues, Carl and Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Leanne.
Yes, it's me. You just live it.
You can hear full songs from Big Blue Ball in the music section of npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.